Welcome to the Dr. Mike Show. This is Dr. Michael McGee here, and we're very, very fortunate today to have as our guest Joffrey McClung, who is a personal growth author and motivational speaker, and is the author of a recent book on self-love called The Heart of the Matter. And she's here to talk with us today about self-love. Welcome, Joffrey.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I'm happy to be with you.
It's great to have you. So tell us a little bit about how did you get into this topic of self-love and become...
Well, I came around a long way, so to speak, Dr. Mike. I started out back in the day in theater world on stage as well as behind stage, and then moved to film and did all of that. And then I hit a dark night of the soul, as we all tend to do occasionally, and I began to read all the personal growth books. I read all the spirituality books. I read everything I could get my hands on to figure out what I could do to make changes in my life. And basically, through the years, I did lots and lots of work, lots of affirmations, lots of techniques, went to a lot of seminars, all that good stuff. But the truth of the matter is, I still wasn't changing that much. Until I finally hit this period in my life when my mother got cancer, and I came back to Texas to take care of her so that she could, you know, live her life, her last 2 years, doing what she wanted to do. And I used that to finish up my inner work. And what I had discovered was, down besides the affirmations, the rituals, the techniques, whatever you were doing to change your life, it all boils down to self-love. You're either moving through the world in self-love or you are not. And when you look inward and you really look in your, what I call your inner mirror of truth, most of us aren't walking around fully embraced in self-love. We've got weaknesses. We've got flaws. So I did my work on that. And then once I got through, my mother did pass on. I needed to get some kind of creativity moving, and I thought, well, I'll write a script. That's what I had done most of my life, and my profession was writing scripts. I thought, I'll write a script. Well, the script felt silly to me after going through my, you know, helping my mother deal with cancer and dealing with her problems. The script just felt silly, Dr. Mike. So I suddenly got the hit that I needed to write about what I had gone through, because at the same time that my mother had passed, I found out my best friend, really my soul sister in all honesty, had stage 4 breast cancer. So here I was grieving my mother, and now I was happening to help my best friend also go through cancer. So I was like at my wit's end, to be honest with you, and I needed to do something. So I wrote my first book, which was How Learning to Say Goodbye Taught Me How to Live, really as a way to talk about what my best friend and I were doing to move through her stage 4 cancer. And when I came out of that first book, my friend did move on. She did pass. And I wrote the book during her last 6 months of her life, because we both did spiritual inner work and did self-love work. That when I came out of that grief of her, I realized that first book was written for people who were well on their way in self-love. But it did not tell people how to get to self-love. So that's what made me write the second book, The Heart of the Matter, which is a workbook and guide to finding your way back to self-love, to help people know that you can find your way back to self-love. It takes work, it takes diligence, but you can do it. That's how I started the second book, to be honest with you.
Wow. Why is self-love so important to people's lives?
Well, in truth of the matter is that what I always say, self-love or the lack of self-love determines how we see ourselves and also governs how we experience the world around us. I think in the book I say it's the prism through which we see and define all things. In other words, it colors everything that comes into your life, and everything you put out into the world is colored by your self-love. Whether you have a little or a lot, it determines what you're going to experience in this world. And I really do believe, looking around this world and just frankly watching the news, most of us can do some building in our self-love area, frankly. Build it up so that we can move through in self-love, and we don't have to be reactionary to people or on guard against people. We can actually move through the world with an open heart and an open mind.
What causes people to have so much difficulty connecting to self-love?
Well, I think it starts really when we're young. When you're little, you're told how life is supposed to be. Your parents are teaching you. Your teachers are teaching you. Your priest, you're at the mosque, at the temple, wherever you happen to be going, you're told how life should be. And so things tend to go wrong, and we tend to think that it's our fault that things are going wrong. We're too little to understand that that person may have an issue. For instance, you may have jealousy coming at you, and you think, oh, that's my problem. I caused that. Well, no, that's really that person's problem, not yours. But because we're little, we take it on ourselves. So we take it on, we make up these beliefs around it, and we shove it down, and we keep moving through the world until we're adults. Then as adults, we don't realize we're walking around with these little parts of ourselves running our lives because we never took time to heal these other parts of ourselves. So really, I think the problem that most people have is that they think if I get the right house, I get the right job, I get the right relationship, then my life will be great. But what they don't realize is you can have all those things, and secretly you still feel like you're lacking in something because you're lacking in self-love. You're looking for your value and your feelings being good enough or your worth outside of yourself. And as long as we keep doing that, we're going to have that sense of lacking something, and it's lacking in self-love.
That is so, so well said. A lack of self-love or even self-hatred is really linked to the experience of trauma and neglect for so many of us growing up, right?
Oh, I certainly think so. I don't know anybody who didn't have some sort of trauma or childhood. Something happened when they were younger that they carried with them. Now, some are big and some are small. The big ones, we tend to shove down and ignore them, thinking they're not going to hurt us. And, of course, they're making all our decisions for us. And the little ones, they're less important. But the big ones, I think most people have one or two traumas in their life that they need to deal with in order to totally be free so they can love themselves. I talk about to a lot of people, I call them our inner orphans. We all have an inner orphan that needs to be listened to, needs to be heard, needs to be recognized, and then needs to be offered love so it can be brought back to the whole. And the orphan is strictly the part of you that you've disowned or you've forgotten about or you have shunned because you feel like you don't need it, it's too weak, it's too vulnerable, you don't need to go there. But the truth of the matter is these orphans also have our gifts. They have our dreams, our joy, our power. So really, self-love is not just about self-love. It's about healing those parts of yourself that did have drama or abuse or whatever happened to you when you were younger that you feel like is gone. But if you look at how you behave around certain people, you realize they're still running your life.
Can you give an example, for example, perhaps from your life or from somebody you know, of this inner orphan and how to go through the process of healing it and loving it?
Oh, certainly. Well, the first thing is you want to ask yourself questions. That's how I start with everybody. Ask yourself these questions. So in each chapter of my book, it has all these questions you ask yourself. Well, I always say you got to not just go with the first answer you get, because the first answer will be the answer you're used to giving yourself. It's the excuse answer. Well, that's why I feel this way. So you got to be able to ask yourself questions. So let's say, for instance, in my life, I dealt with some jealousy in my life that came out through anger and caused a lot of drama in my life as a child. So I'd ask myself questions, and then I realized when I was asking myself these questions that I came up with beliefs that it was my fault that I made the person jealous. There's something wrong with me, or my family member would not be so jealous of me or so angry at me, or what really, in all honesty, when talking to the orphan, hate me, because that's what it felt like. They hated you. So you ask yourself questions, and you've got to be as honest as you possibly can. And that, frankly, takes some work, Dr. Mike, because I don't know about you, but we get real comfortable with the answers we're used to giving ourselves until something traumatic happens in life or we hit a dark night of the soul. And then when everything's falling out around us, we go, okay, you know what? I'm telling everybody I believe. It's not what I really believe. So you've got to be careful with the questions and answer them as honestly as possible. So mine was jealousy. So I had jealous issues. So I knew that was an issue, and I worked around it with affirmations and rituals, and it wasn't until I started dealing with the orphan that I began to be able to heal it. And what I did is I called the orphan in, and I began to dialogue with the orphan. I did it in meditation. You can do it just laying on your bed. You don't have to do anything big deal about it. Meditation is just closing your eyes and focusing your attention, frankly. But I would dialogue with the orphan and say, hello. First of all, I would introduce myself. I'm your future self. What do you need to say? Now, a lot of times, the orphan would appear different ways. The first time it appeared, it in a cave. She was in a cave. She was like 5 or 6. She was all dirty, all matted, filthy, living in a cave, and really wanted nothing to do with me, frankly, Dr. Mike. I had ignored her for so many years. She wanted nothing to do with me. So I just sat with her and said, well, I'm going to be here for you because I know you got something to say, and I'm willing to hear you, and I'm going to keep coming back. So I did that a few times in meditation, and then eventually she began to talk to me and began to tell me her fears and her pain. And you just listen to them. You listen to them how they need to be listened to. Like I said, she was in a cave. She became a little more vocal with me. I went back, and then another one appeared in the middle of a garden that I was in meditation with and began shouting at me. Well, she needed to shout at me. She was full of rage and anger, so I let her shout at me. You need to listen to your orphan. You just need to listen to them. It may take time to get them to talk to you, to share their feelings with you, but if you'll keep going back and saying, I'm going to keep coming back because I love you and I want to help you, they will share their feelings with you. So you got to listen, number one. Listen, listen, listen. And then once they trust you and know you're going to keep returning and listening to them, then you can begin to offer them love. You begin to offer them something different than what they believe. For instance, my one that thought she was made wrong because she made people so jealous and angry at her, I began to explain to her that wasn't true, that that was her problem, that you're beautiful, you're lovely, this is not your issue. You begin to talk to them how they needed to be talked to, frankly. So I began to tell her it wasn't her problem, that she was beautiful, she was joyous, that she was wonderful just the way she was. And I did that over and over again. And then she began to listen to me and begin to believe me. You want them to believe you. It's got to be locked in the heart as well as the mind. I know everybody likes to work with the mind, but those wounds get locked in your heart. Those really core wounds you get as a child get locked in your heart. And then all those negative beliefs come out of that place as well. So you've got to listen to them, and you've got to offer them love, how they need it. And they will let you know whether they're believing you or not. It will take a little time, but they'll let you know. And then you can begin to bring them back to the whole by letting them know that they're safe to be who they can be. They're safe to be who they're supposed to be, and they don't need to be in charge anymore. That's the third part. They do not need to be in charge. That they can go and play. They can be fruitful. They can be 7-year-olds or 6-year-olds at whatever age they are. That you're in charge. That they're loved and they're cared for, and they do not need to be in charge of your life anymore. That's sort of how you deal with the orphans, in a sense. It takes time, though, Mike. Dealing with your wounds takes time. I'm not going to lie and say, oh, you do this in, 3 sessions and you're healed. It takes time, but it's wonderful time because you fall in love with yourself. That's
how much time did it take for you to go through this process?
Well, it took a while because I did it in segments. I would hit a level. I would get to know this orphan, like the cave one. I'd get to know her, tell her I loved her. Then she began to crawl into my lap and feel safe. And I said, you're safe. So I thought, okay, I've hit it. That's great. And my life got a little better, and it felt good. And then something would happen in my life, and I realized, there's another level to this. I'd go back in there, and that's where I met the one that was screaming at me in the garden. She was full of rage. She was a bit older. She appeared to me a bit older than 6 or 7. She was more like 8 or 9 or 10, and she was full of rage and anger. That people had allowed this drama to go on and no one had protected her. So I listened to her and let her vent. That took time because I would go in there, I'd be drained when I was done, and I always end my meditation full of love. I fill her with love and I fill myself with love. That's really important to end any kind of work you do with the energy of love, because you want to change the harm into love. So I listened for a while and listened, let her yell at me several times, many times. I'd say it took, because I did it every night. I was destined to get this stuff done. But some people may do it once a week. It just takes time. I would say I listened to her yelling at me for about 3 weeks. She had 3 weeks worth to say to me. So I listened for a good 3 weeks every night. And then I began to talk to her and offer her a different viewpoint of what happened, and that people did care about her, that she wasn't murdered, was she? She was kept safe. you know, begin to give her a different perspective on what happened. That took time because I needed to learn what I needed to say to her. It's that big circle. I talked about it. It's like a circle, Mike, that you start out trying to help them, and then I turn to my what I call my higher self, which is just really your wise one that hasn't, you know, forgotten that it's one with the divine. But I turned to my wise one, and she would tell me what to say to the orphan so that I could understand what I needed to learn so I could pass it on to the orphan. It's like this circle you go through. So it does take time to know what you need to give to the orphan because you need to learn it as well. Because in truth, you are the orphan, in all honesty. You are these parts. But it's easier to work with them in parts than to try to do it as a whole, at least I've found.
I have to say, the work that you're doing to look deeply and honestly at the reality of your being and the parts of our being, these different sort of gestalt-type selves that we have fractured within us, the work to look honestly and deeply the way that you've done, I respect so much because it takes a lot of courage and a lot of determination to do what you've done.
It does take a lot of courage. That's why I try to tell people this isn't easy work. And a lot of people don't come to do this work on this planet. They just did not come to wake up for this. But a lot of people did. A lot of people do want to heal their wounds. They do want to fall back in love with themselves. They do want to walk with an open heart and open mind. But it takes courage to look inwardly and to own what you're feeling, not to judge what you're feeling. That rage that came out of the one standing in the garden yelling at me with rage and anger. Because rage was a bit of a hard one for me to get to. Doesn't mean I didn't feel it as a young one, but I had to shut it down because there was so much rage around me that I didn't want to add any more rage to the family. I wanted to, in a way, protect my mother, that I shoved it down. So it took a while for me to own my rage. That takes courage, but I tell you, there is nothing like the freedom of looking inward, finding this courage. No, there is no emotion that's going to kill you, people. That's something I also tell people. I don't want to feel that. I don't want to feel my anger. I don't want to feel my rage. I don't want to feel my hurt. Well, you're feeling it anyway. You may just be shoving it down, but you are feeling it and you're carrying it in your body anyway. It's better to bring it up and out of you so that you can transform it with love. But feeling that rage was so, it was frightening as hell to feel it. But I have to say there was such a freedom in allowing that rage to be vented. That's why it took me 3 weeks every night. I mean, and I say 3 weeks every night. I mean, I spend a good hour. I usually do it in the tub because I like the hot water to help me get to it. I'd spend an hour doing it, and then I would spend a few minutes afterwards, you know, like I said, filling myself up with love. But feeling that rage was so empowering that I had to just realize how much rage I had been holding in. And once I was able to release that, I do not have outbursts anymore. Because I would be at work in the day. When you're doing this homework, you can be a little bit raw because you're opening up to these parts of yourself, frankly. So I'd be at work, and I had the perfect job. I had the perfect boss. I had the perfect environment to do this work because they were all guys, and they all had tantrums constantly, I hate to say. But these guys, they were full of tantrums. So I was in a good environment so that if I lost my cookies at work, it was okay because everybody else was losing their cookies at work too. But there would be times I'd be willing at work that I would have an outburst. Something would be said at me, and I just outburst and say, and kind of shout and say, well, that's just ridiculous, and have that. Well, once I dealt with my rage, I don't have that as much anymore. In fact, I have it very little anymore, frankly. So yeah. It does take courage. It takes diligence. It takes usually a dark night of the soul to get people to look inward, frankly. I don't know anyone who does it just for the fun of it. At least I don't know anybody. Maybe you do, but I don't.
No, well, you know, I think you've had sort of a... Well, for a couple of things, if you want to heal it, you've got to feel it, and that takes the kind of courage and determination that you've shown. But wouldn't you say that it's been worth it? I mean, this ability to sort of go into the center of your pain and truly feel it sounds like it has been absolutely transformative for you.
Oh, it's been absolutely fabulous. Now, it's interesting because, like I said, in the beginning, I was an actor in New York City, and so I was used to emotions, but again, emotions under a very constrained way through a script, giving me certain ways to do it. So it's interesting how life sets you up for what you need, because that set me up to deal with emotions in meditation. because emotions I was used to. Again, the rage was a bit tough for me to get to, but I got to it. But emotions, I now say, are our navigational system for life. None of us are taught how to work with emotions. We're taught to don't have that emotion. That's a bad emotion to have. Whatever it is, we're told emotions only feel good, don't feel bad. You know, that's what we deal with. But emotions, navigational system through life, which hopefully we'll pick up in our when we get back to this, I'm so glad I did the emotional work. I highly recommend it to everyone.
You are an example for the world, and it's so good to hear your story. And this is something that is going to be hopefully really inspiring for people who are suffering from self-hatred. This is Dr. Michael McGee. This is the Dr. Mike Well Mind with Dr. Mike show, and we have with us Joffrey McClung talking about self-love. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to the Well Mind with Dr. Mike show. This is Dr. Michael McGee, your host. We have with us today Joffrey McClung, the author of a book on self-love called The Heart of the Matter. Welcome back, Joffrey.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
So tell us, you've talked a lot about the courage to look deeply and honestly at ourselves and face and embrace and work through our pain. And in that process, really healing and transforming. What is it about our belief system, do you think, that keeps us from self-love? You talked a little bit about feelings of pain. What about beliefs? What about thoughts and beliefs?
Well, our beliefs basically run our lives, frankly. What you believe is what you're going to create, frankly. And what we were talking about earlier, the orphan work we were talking about, out of those wounds when we're children, and actually everything we decide about life is pretty much decided as a child. As a child, you come up with your beliefs of how the world's going to work for you and how the world is going to see you and treat you. Now, if it's a loving, wonderful environment, then the world's going to be loving and kind and treat you lovingly. But if you're like most people, most of us have ups and downs in our childhood. So some is loving and then some aren't so loving. Well, those not so loving moments create those negative beliefs, what I call the negative beliefs. And those beliefs come out of those wounds from the orphan. Like I said earlier, the jealousy. I had a belief that there was something wrong with me, otherwise I would not have a family member who was so angry at me. Well, out of that became several negative beliefs were born out of that core belief that something's wrong with me. One was, I can't have what I want. Well, that sounds like, well, how could that happen, come out of that? Because if I have what I want, it could cause someone to become jealous of me and hurt me and harm me. Okay, there's a negative belief. So I would do theater, or I would do film, or I would do commercials. I'd get jobs, I'd book gigs, but I'd only get so far. I'd only get so far before the wall would come down. And teachers or whatnot would say, well, I don't understand why you're not getting more work. Well, I had that belief in there that I can only have so much, because if I get too good stuff or get too noticed, then they'll get jealous and I'll be harmed. That's a negative belief. Another negative belief that came out of the jealousy is that you cannot do what you want to do at all. And that's a little different. It sounds similar to the other belief I just said, but it's a little different. You cannot have what you want. It's a slightly different belief. So, again, I would do something and I could not have what I wanted. So negative beliefs come out of our wounds. Negative belief, that's why people become people pleasers. I see a lot of that, especially with women, become people pleasers. That makes them feel they'll be safe. That is based on a negative belief system that they're not safe, there's something wrong with them, they're not valuable, they're not lovable, they're not good enough. Therefore, they need to please people in order to be safe or to feel like they're loved. Negative beliefs, I believe we'll constantly be changing our beliefs to our last breath, because once you hit self-love and you have a firm base in self-love, you're going to have new beliefs that need to be expanded. Like I had a belief once I came out of my lack of self-love that I can have what I want. We just talked about I can't have what I want, I can have what I want. Well, that was working, but I kept feeling like, okay, there's a bit of a wall. And then I decided that the universe wants me to have what I want. That gave me a little more breathing space in creating what I wanted. And then it was, I can have what I want, and it can be bigger and better than I can imagine. Spread that belief a little bit bigger. It's like I had a friend recently, since we're talking about negative beliefs, that has some old age beliefs. He's in his 50s. and he doesn't have a lot of money saved, but he's still working, but he's going through this belief system of what old age is going to be for him. It's going to be hard. He doesn't have a home. He doesn't have this. What? How is he going to pay for this? How's insurance going to work? All these fears are coming up. And I said, and he says, well, I'm doing my affirmations. And I said, well, affirmations are great when you've changed the negative belief to a positive belief. It's a good way to keep your mind, you know, in the right gear to know what you want to, you know, focus on. But if you haven't changed your heart with, change the negative belief to a positive belief, affirmations are just really sort of a waste of time. And I said, you might want to look at what you believe about old age and change those negative beliefs to positive beliefs. Well, he called me back like 2 days later and goes, well, I had about 3 or 4 that were really sucky. That's how he said it. They were really funky. He'd watched his grandfather hurting. His parents had struggled with money. He had several different beliefs that he had picked up along the way that he was putting on to himself. So he went and he changed them to more positive beliefs. Now he can do the affirmations. They'll work. But he had to do the positive belief work first. Affirmations are only good once you've changed the negative belief to a positive belief. Does that make any sense to you?
Absolutely. You know, in my book, The Joy of Recovery, I have a chapter entitled Don't Believe Everything You Think. And I think that beliefs are tricky, that they can be very, very constraining. I think the issue around positive beliefs is that they have to be something believable and realistic to somebody for them to truly believe and embrace them. How do you change from discard negative beliefs and adopt more positive beliefs?
Well, I go into meditation. Everything I do, pretty much, I go into meditation. And there's a negative belief that I can't have what I want because I'll get hurt. I go in there and I look at the belief and I feel it. I feel my way through things. A lot of people think their way through things, and that can work too, but I use my feelings to work through it. And I look at why I have that belief to begin with, and I realize it came out of when I was younger, and it came out of a fear. So once I got my mind knowing that came out of fear, okay, that's not the truth of the matter. No one told me. There's nothing written in the whole of the universe that says I cannot have what I want. That is something I decided out of fear and pain and not wanting to be made to feel unsafe, frankly. So once I get that going in my head, then I can say, okay, what can I believe? What can I believe? Can I believe that I can have some of what I want? Well, that's how I worked this one, because I had to do it in sections. I couldn't go to I can have everything I want, because I wasn't going to buy that. I said, can I have some of the things I want? So I worked on that for a bit. Yes, I can have some of the things I want. I'm allowed to have some of the things I want. Again, knowing I'm the one who's allowing it to begin with. There is no being who's saying I cannot have what I want. It's me making that decision. So it's done in sections. So I decided I can have some of what I want. And then I started to say, you know what, I can have what I want. And then what I want, depending on what I want, I can't say I'm going to be an opera singer because I've never sung opera. So there does have to be a logic to it. But I can have what I want in the heart, in my heart, what I really want in my heart. Do I want this in my heart? I can have what I want. And then I decided to add the universe because I was working on God issues in my belief system, because we pick up God issues as well, or goddess, or whatever you want to call it, divine universe issues. I was clearing some old negative beliefs I'd picked up along that. So I decided to add the universe in there and say the universe also is on my side, because that was helping me work with my divine issues. So you just do it in sections, and you got to believe, just like you said, you got to believe it. It's got to be real to you. Like I was telling my friend about the old age, you can't say, I'm going to be a multimillionaire when I'm 80 years old. I said, you got to work up to what you want in your older age. You've got to work it up. Right now you're figuring you're going to be feeble in a wheelchair by the time you're 65 with no money. So you got to work out of that one slowly and decide, I'm going to be healthy. I'm going to be strong. Work that way, and then you can add the things you want to do, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You write about safety nets.
Oh, yes.
I wonder if you could explain a little bit. What are safety nets, and how do they keep us from self-love?
Well, our safety net, the way I think I describe it in the book, is they are our go-to behaviors whenever we are feeling powerless, unloved, or unlovable. So when we're feeling powerless, unloved, or unlovable, we turn our safety nets on. And our safety nets are judgment, control, needing to be right, people pleaser. That's just to name a few of them. These are the things we go to whenever we're feeling powerless or unloved. You know, people who go to judgment constantly, you think, well, that's just who they are. That's not really who they are. That's not who they were when they were younger. That's something that they put onto themselves to protect themselves. Control, needing to be right. These are all things to make us feel safe and loved or lovable. Our safety nets are really something we've got to look at. We've got to own that we do this. When you're controlling somebody, you're really protecting the fact that you don't feel good enough. When you're judging somebody, you're really hiding from the fact that you don't feel worthy. You know, when you're needing to be right, you're not feeling that you matter to the universe. You need to be right to show that you matter. These all come from a lack of self-love, and we need to look at them so we stop doing them to people. We need to stop acting out to people, frankly.
Right. So we need to let go of the safety nets and really give ourselves over with a certain degree of faith to our essential goodness and trust in our goodness as we navigate through the world.
Exactly.
Well, this is a great conversation. You're listening to The Well Mind with Dr. Mike Show, with Dr. Michael McGee here as your host, and Joffrey McClung, our guest, the author of The Heart of the Matter. And we'll be right back with you after this break. Welcome back to The Well Mind with Dr. Mike Show, with Dr. Michael McGee here, your host. We have with us as our guest Joffrey McClung, the author of The Heart of the Matter, a workbook and guide to finding your way back to self-love. We were talking, Joffrey, before the break about safety nets, and you were talking about using safety nets as sort of a navigational system to manage emotions of feeling unsafe or unloved or unlovable. Any further thoughts you have about that?
Yeah, I was going to say a little bit more on that, and thank you for asking. The safety nets, they're triggered whenever you do feel powerless, unloved, or unlovable. So you use that. When you find that you've been judgmental at work or you stood your ground and you needed to be right to the point that you ended up losing a friend, you need to stop and ask yourself, what caused me to do that? Use it for your homework. Your emotions are going to tell you where you're off kilter, where you need to look. That's why you want to work with emotions, because they'll guide you where you need to be healing yourself. So if you're judgmental or controlling or need to be right, or a people pleaser is another safety net, people. I want that to be made real clear, because that comes out of wanting to feel safe as well, that you need to stop yourself, come home that day. Maybe you didn't catch yourself in the moment and you went ahead and were controlling or pleased people or did whatever you needed to do. Go home and ask yourself, why did I do that? What did it make me feel powerless or unloved or unlovable that made me dig my heels in? Because that's where you want to do the homework. You don't want to do the homework just on judgment or control or needing to be right. Those are clues to that you've got more homework to do on your orphan and your belief system inwardly. So next time you find that, go inward to check it out. And people-pleasing especially, I was raised with a people-pleaser, and I loved my mother to pieces. I just adored her. But she became a people-pleaser to protect herself, to keep herself safe. And she shoved all of her emotions down. She did not allow herself to get angry. And she had many reasons to be angry, frankly. That she shoved them down to where she was unable to feel joy. Now, she laughed with her friends and whatnot, but there was such a low level of it, because I watched her from little being a little kid to being a full adult, that I noticed the change. And that happened from her shoving her emotions down. So when you're in judgment or control or needing to be right or a people pleaser, use it to look inward at where you need to listen to your orphan and send that orphan some love. Listen to that orphan. Let it tell you where it's hurting, why it's so angry, why it's hurting, why it feels so unloved, why it feels powerless, so that you can give it that power, that love, that feeling that it's good enough, that it's valuable. The way I describe self-love in the book is really simple. It's knowing in your heart that your being is lovable, loving, and loved. Lovable means you are worthy of love. You exist, therefore you are worthy of love. Doesn't matter if another human being ever gives it to you. The universe knows you are worthy of love. Loving means that you are given a natural loving heart that's waiting to be expressed uniquely through you. And the way you express that loving heart is good enough. You are good enough with your loving, whether it's creative, whether it's in relationships or in business. It is good enough. And loved, you exist. Therefore, you matter to the universe, and you are valued by the universe. When you have those three components locked in your heart, you can move through the world with an open heart and open mind and go for your dreams big style, frankly.
That's wonderful, to be lovable, to be loving, and to be loved.
And to know that that is a true piece of your beingness. Now, your personality may have aspects that aren't so great because you put aspects up of judgment or control or needing to be right. You put up all these walls to protect yourself from the dangerous world that's all around you. But who you are in your heart, without all those walls around it, is lovable, loving, and loved. And if we could all move through the world a bit more lovable, loving, and loved, what a better world this would be, frankly.
Yes, absolutely. And one thing I'm hearing that you're saying that probably should be pointed out here is that it's really you're getting into connection with that ultimate truth of love, the truth of love of existence is through your deep meditation and again being shining the light of your awareness on these different parts of yourself, the trauma parts or the hurt parts of yourself. And shining that love on those wounded parts, which leads to a natural healing process that you've gone through and that people who do this go through. And if you go through that, so I just wanted to point out that in what you're saying, that the practice of stillness and meditation is so essential for this healing process, no?
Oh, it's imperative. And again, the way I describe meditation is strictly I close my eyes and focusing your attention. Now, some use it to ground themselves and just focus on their breathing or their muscles, but I use it to actually go deeper and connect with those orphan parts. And I also want to connect. I also connect with my higher self, which people can call intuition. They can call it their higher being. I don't really care the label you give it. But there's a part of you that does see 360 degrees around, that does see the forest and the trees at the same time. And so you also connect with the parts of you that are already full of love, so they can guide you to heal. So it's not just healing, going into meditation to meet those orphan parts, but also meeting your higher self and what you call your magical child, so to speak, the part of you that remembers joy, the power of joy, because you need to balance all of this inner healing work with love. It really is redefining love for yourself, frankly, Dr. Mike. This inner work, this whole book I wrote, is really redefining for yourself, not letting anyone else tell you what love should feel like or be like, redefining what love should be for you and finding it inwardly in your heart, not outside of yourself. And here's something which is really interesting. When I did this work, I did it for myself because I wanted to feel better about myself. I wanted to stop that inner dialogue, that those negative voices that said you can't have this or someone's better than you, whatever was happening to be saying. What happened is, as I became more compassionate, loving, and kind with myself, I automatically became more loving, compassionate, and kind with other people. Now, that kind of surprised me. Now that I've done some work and looked back and read some psychology books, I realize anybody with a higher sense of self-esteem has more compassion and empathy for other people. But I didn't know that when I started out. I started out just for me, but actually became more of a loving human being for other people as well, which I find very interesting.
Absolutely. Compassion for others starts with compassion for ourselves. How can we spill out love onto the world if we're not feeling happy and full of joy ourselves? We have to fill our own cup first before we can then water other people with our abundance.
Oh, you've got that, Tony. If you're busy looking for your value and your worth and your feelings of being good enough outside of yourself, some days you're going to get it, other days you're not. Well, when you're not getting it, you're not going to be that kind to people.
Yeah,
I've seen it many times. I've done it myself. When you're looking for something outside of yourself, you tend to be kind of angry at the world because the world is never going to give it to you. It just isn't. It goes up and down. That's what life's about. But you can always close your eyes. I don't care if you sit in a chair or lay down or take a hot bath. You can close your eyes and you can dip into your own sense of love yourself. There are times that I needed to feel appreciated. I wasn't being appreciated at work. Well, I wasn't going to get it at work. That just wasn't that environment. So I would go home and I would go into meditation, close my eyes. I put some music on because I think music is great for meditation. I put some music on and I would envision myself being appreciated. I would see me being surrounded by people applauding me, cheering me, making me feel appreciated. So you can give all of these things to yourself. That's what I really want people to understand. You can love yourself. You can appreciate yourself. You can find value for yourself. You can find worth for yourself. And you can be good enough for yourself.
Absolutely. So true. And what you said in your meditation practices, I think that that sense of love and reverence really arises from the place of stillness that you tap into at the deeper parts of yourself. And it's always there for everybody to experience. Well, this is Dr. Michael McGee. This is the Well Mind with Dr. Mike show with Joffe McClung. And we will be back to talk more about self-love after this break. Welcome back to the Well Mind with Dr. Mike show. This is Dr. Michael McGee, your host. We have Joffe McClung with us, the author of The Heart of the Matter, a book about self-love. Welcome back, Joffe.
Hey, glad to be here.
You know, there's a lot of buzz now in the world about the topic of self-compassion. The work of Kristen Neff and others has really made that a popular topic. How is self-love the same or different from self-compassion?
I love this question. I love self-compassion. I call self-compassion a part of self-love. Self-love is the big bubble. Self-compassion's a piece of that bubble. Self-compassion I use when we're looking, when you're healing your orphan, you've healed your orphan, and you've looked at the things you've done in your life to other people because of your orphan. Your negative beliefs cause you to behave badly or whatnot. You've got to look at your actions. And when you look at your actions, you look at it with self-compassion, understanding. When I was 20, I didn't know at that time. I was walking around with these negative beliefs, so I acted out. You can have self-compassion for the reason you behaved badly, the reason you spoke badly. Self-compassion really is a form of forgiveness. Having self-compassion of where you were at that time is vital for your stumbles and mistakes. Self-compassion is a piece of self-love, just like self-acceptance is a piece of self-love. Self-acceptance, accepting that you have flaws and weaknesses. We're human beings. We're not made perfect. We're going to have flaws and weaknesses. But when you can accept your flaws and weaknesses with less judgment, then you're practicing self-acceptance. So self-compassion is forgiving your mistakes and your stumbles, understanding you're doing the best you can in the moment, every moment. And once you have self-compassion, you have much more compassion for other people's stumbles and mistakes. When you have self-acceptance for your flaws and weaknesses, you have much more acceptance of others' flaws and weaknesses. You're much less judgmental. You know, when you stop looking outside of yourself for validation and instead learn to have self-appreciation and self-gratitude, which is another word I like to add to self-love, self-gratitude, you actually have more appreciation and gratitude for other people. I do a whole thing about self-gratitude, that it's great to have gratitude for what's in your life, the people in your life, your job, your home, your whatever it is that's bringing you joy and making you feel safe and loved. It's great. But when you have self-gratitude, when you're able to be grateful for who you are, not for what you do or what you will do, but who you are, that is self-gratitude. So what I do is I have people do three things every night when they get home that they're grateful for that they did. Now, it's not about work you did or making money. That's looking for value outside of yourself. It's something you did that makes you feel good about being you. Perhaps you made somebody laugh at work. So be grateful that you have a sense of humor. Be grateful you have this sense of humor. Perhaps you gave spare change to somebody on the street. Be grateful that you have this sense of being able to hand somebody something that they need. Perhaps you were kind to somebody. Be grateful for your kind heart. That's practicing self-gratitude. And self-compassion, again, since that was what you asked me about, is a key component of self-love, just like self-acceptance, self-gratitude, self-appreciation. Those are all components to me of self-love.
That's wonderful. I think of self-compassion as feeling our suffering and wishing for us to not suffer, and doing things to help ourselves to not suffer. And I like your use of the word self-appreciation, which is sort of an unconditional reverence for the reality of who we are, and in my thinking that we can only be exactly who we are, that we don't choose our genes, we don't choose our brains, we don't choose feelings, at least not directly, and so we can't change who we are, and appreciation is sort of a larger loving practice of just radical reverence and acceptance for things and for ourselves exactly as we are.
I love that. I totally agree with that. To appreciate yourself is to really appreciate that you're alive and that you're breathing and that's good enough. That's really good enough. And to be have self-gratitude just takes it a step further. To say, I'm not just happy I'm alive. I'm grateful I am who I am. Just in this moment.
Wonderful. And really to appreciate our gifts and also perhaps even appreciate our flaws, because our flaws can be the greatest sources of growth and wisdom.
You got that right.
Yeah.
Oh, it's your flaws. Your flaws are one of your greatest teachers are your flaws.
Right.
Your flaws end up showing you where you need to grow. They end up giving you more compassion for other people because you realize you're not perfect.
So
when you own your flaws.
So in self-love, we would appreciate our flaws and weaknesses.
Oh, exactly. You have to, because we all have them. In fact, my flaws ended up being some of my strengths. I thought my flaws was I'm gonna get through this, I'm gonna do this. And actually, my flaws are what led me to do the inner work.
That's wonderful.
So in a weird way, your flaws can guide you where you need to go.
Exactly. They are a gift. Our flaws are a gift. So how you talked a lot, Joffrey, about self-love, and I just like to sort of wrap up the remaining minutes we have. Describe for me how your life or how other people's lives have transformed by reconnecting and to self-love. What kind of changes do you see in your life and in other people's lives?
Well, in my life, it's 180 degrees, frankly, from the work I started out doing when I started this work back, gosh, so many decades ago, it feels like, doing this inner work. And when I finally got the idea that it was self-love and did that work, my life shifted 180 degrees. I never thought I'd be writing these personal growth spiritual books. That was not part of my game plan, so to speak. I thought I would keep doing television production, which is what I did in New York City. I made short films. I made a feature film. I thought I'll stay in that. Well, this made me change 180 degrees, and you know what? I'm loving every second of it. So that's a big change, because this was something I kept very private. I kept my inner work, except for people who did their inner work as well. I had two groups. I had my spiritual group, and then I had my work group, so I kept them separate. But when I did this book and did both books, I kind of came out of the spiritual closet, so to speak. So that's 180 degrees for me. And the way I feel is, I feel so much freer, like I don't have this ball and chain around my neck anymore, that I can do anything that I put my mind to. Again, realistically, obviously I'm not going to be an opera singer, but I can put my mind to, I can do anything. And it's just kind of now I'm using my, what I call that magical child, that joyful part of myself, to say, what do I want to experience next? Versus in the old days, it was about, what can I experience? Then I'll feel better about myself. Then I'll have something. Now it's about, what do I want to experience? That's a big shift for me. You know, what do I want to get? And as far as other people, I've seen great changes. I've seen people go from having anxiety to being much more relaxed, being able to do a meditation and get out of pain so much quicker. It's just amazing. I definitely say self-love can change your life like nothing else before.
Yeah. Really, really wonderful. I imagine that you sound to me like a very joyful person, and that you have a lot of peace and lightness to your being, Joffrey, that comes out of your work in terms of releasing and connecting with your self-love.
Well, thank you so much. I do feel joyful. I actually felt joyful before, but it was sort of a forced joy. This is a real joy now. This is coming from my heart. This is coming from... So thank you for saying that. I greatly appreciate hearing that.
Very nice. Well, you've been listening to the Well Mind with Dr. Mike show. Dr. Michael McGee here with Joffrey McClung, the author of The Heart of the Matter, a book on self-love. And it's been great having you, and hope that this discussion is inspiring. Joffrey, where can people find you if they want to learn more about you?
Well, they can find me at joffreymcclung.com, or you can just type in itsallaboutselflove.com, itsallaboutselflove.com. That'll take you to my website, too.
Okay, very good. Well, good luck with your continued work, and I hope that you bring love and joy to many, many people.
Well, thank you so much, and thanks for having me, Dr. Mike. I greatly appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure. Bye-bye.